Hello there, and once again, you're very welcome to Terrace Talk. We shall forward with you as usual until 8 o'clock. And take note, as tonight's programme is pre-recorded, our phone lines are not open. Well, my special guest tonight is a man who has been involved with Ireland's international soccer team for nearly 30 years. And as you sit back and listen to this Terrace Talk, he is out in Japan playing a most crucial part in our country's attempt to advance to the World Cup. His face will be seen on TV screens all over the world. Mick Byrne, Irish physiotherapist and former Dublin physiotherapist, Galway physiotherapist, you're very welcome to Terrace Talk and Radio Kerry.
Yeah, thank you very much, Roisin. It's nice to be here. Nice to be talking to you.
Of course, Mick, Kerry, you came down in Hull. The first time I ever met you was in Kerry, actually, behind in Raspy. You have a lot of connections in Kerry as such.
Well, yeah, I love Kerry, and I love going down on holidays. We spent probably most of my life down in Kerry, Glenbey in particular, Killarney, and until the kids got sick of going down, to be honest with you, and they wanted to fly the nest and went off on their own. But Kerry has tremendous memories for me. I mean, it's just, well, it's part of heaven, I think. It's a beautiful part of the country.
And as very lately, you visited a great GA house behind in Beaufort, and with a great soccer background now, Mick.
That's right, Gary Breen, yeah, all these people come from Beaufort, which was fantastic. And I didn't happen to know this at the time, because Gary never mentioned it when he came into the squad. And I was playing in the golf club in Beaufort, and this lad came over to me and says, Mick, how is Gary? He said, and I thought he was talking about Gary Kelly. And I said, oh yeah, he's great. And he says, well, you know, he lives down here. No, I said, he lives in Drogheda. He says, no, Gary Breen, he says, he just lives down the road, his grandmother's house. I said, you're joking. I said, well, I needn't tell you what I called Gary for not telling me. So the next international, when the squad got together, well, I had a right go at Gary, you know, for hiding the fact that he was from Kerry and all his people were from Kerry. So it was just one of them delightful things that, you know, you find out that here, you know, one of our so-called exiles is actually, you know, his people are all from the heart of Kerry, and it was absolutely brilliant. I was thrilled with that.
And there's another Kerry man, unfortunately, won't make the World Cup, Gary Doherty, with connections in he got a Sports Star Awards in Kerry last year, Mick. Unfortunately, he won't make it, but more background, a lot of good men coming out of Kerry.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, Gary Doherty is a fabulous player. We think he's going to be, definitely you will see him for the future with the Irish team. There's no doubt about that. It was just unfortunate he broke the leg. He'd been out so long. I think he came back, he had 10 minutes with Spurs for his first game, his first run out, and then he played half a game, scored a winning goal against the US. But Gary is a lovely, lovely lad, another great example of the people and the character of the Kerry people. I mean, if you want to meet nicer lads, you'll go and meet Gary Breen and Gary Doherty, two of the nicest lads you could meet.
Mick Byrne, I suppose I'd be insulting my listeners when I was telling them that you're from Dublin, because once you open your mouth, tell us about your background.
Well, my background is from, I'm from the inner city. I'm the son of a docker in Dublin. Lived on the quays most of my life before we started moving around then in the inner city in Dublin, from Townsend Street to Pier Street to Ring's End. Very proud of my Dublin upbringing, very proud of being an inner city person, actually, you know, to make, come out of the inner city and make it the way I have, at the top of my profession, also being involved with President Hillary for 12 years, working with President Hillary for 12 years. I think it just shows you what you can do if you set your mind, no matter what part of the country you come from or what side of the rail track you come from. I mean, you know, inner city people think, oh, you know, everything is against us. It's not. It's what you make of it yourself. And I've made it myself. From the inner city, very, very proud of it. A Dubba heart, but love every part of this country that I live in.
Mick, how difficult was it in growing up in the inner city in those particular times?
Yeah, it was really, well, for myself it was, because my father died when he was 34. So it left my mother, who was a widow in those days, and I'm sure any older people listening to this that were in the same position, she had to go out and do three or four jobs to keep a family of six all together. In which he done, and you know, all praise to her, and I could never ever, she's dead 6 years now, but I could never repay her ever for what she's done for us and for the family, and she was the heartstone of the family, and she kept it going. And you know what I can say to all those other widows or widowers that are out there and have done the same for their families, I mean, what tremendous credit, you know, the families must feel for those people.
Mick, staying with your mother, Latimer, son, because we were all proud of our mothers, I have no doubt she imbued a very deep religious faith in you, because I get the impression after watching you on television that when you met the Pope in Italy, that was one of the highlights of your life. Did all that come from your mother?
Yes, there's no doubt about it. We went to sodality and we went to confession. We were communions, as everyone did in those days, going way back in those days. That we were all that. The sodalities were the big things. The missionaries were the big things. The fear of the missionaries. My God, talking about standing, hair standing on your head, beating the pulpits. I mean, the kids of today wouldn't know what it was to hear a ceremony like that. But again, it was great. Loved every minute of it. My two aunties worked for the priest, and I used to go down and ring the bells and be in the churches, and you know, just on that time. I'm not a religious freak by any sense of the word, but I love my God. I know he's there. I know he's with me. Whatever road I take, he's with me, and I know that. And I have tremendous faith. And meeting the Pope was, for an inner city kid, I mean, meeting the Pope was, what can I say? I mean, to shake hands with him and present him with a football and a jersey with the Irish team was just something I could never ever hope for in my life. That has come true. It's one of the things that you wish for, and this thing came true, which was absolutely unbelievable.
Mick, Gaelic games was your big first involvement, and well known in the Gaelic. Talk me about your Gaelic games life.
Well, Gaelic football and hurling was my life. Hurling, I loved hurling more than I did Gaelic football, but I got more out of Gaelic football in terms of honours than I did out of hurling. But I was 10 years of age when I started in primary school, and that with the school teams, and won the Miller Shield in Croke Park at the age of 10. And I think from then on, listening to Michael O'Hare on the radio every Sunday, going out then, whether it was with a paper ball or a slitter and a hurl, and down in the backyard, in which we had at the time in the inner city, you'd make a goal and you'd be lashing the balls into that, sticking over points, hitting the slitter, and you know, doing all the things that kids did in your mind, because you're actually playing in Croke Park after listening to Micheál. And again, this I joined Clannagael at the age of 10, and Clannagael were my family, because as I said, my father had died, and you know, at an early age, and the mentor was Ted Coolan, which I'll never forget, and I'm deeply indebted to Ted. He picked me up for every match. He used to come around, pick all the kids up, drive us out to the matches, and we used to, you know, Clannagael were fantastic at that time with us. And in talking in Clannagael, the Gaelic people, the people that played Gaelic football, the likes of Kevin Coffey, Donny O'Sullivan, Donny O'Keefe, Tom Long, Mossy O'Donoghue. I can Tig O'Donoghue. I can go on with Kerry names that are great friends of mine, and especially Donal O'Keefe. Donal was a personal friend. Me and Donal hung around together in Dublin. The son of Donal, the great Kerry goalkeeper. And we hung around, and we used to go over to his aunt's. His aunt lived in Fisborough. We go to his aunt's for tea maybe one night, then down to my house another night. So Donald and I were really great friends in that sense.
Were you conscious when you knew him, Mick, about his father?
Oh yeah, we used to talk about it all the time, because Donald was very, very proud of that, and proud of the fact, but never lived on it. He played with Clans as just another player, as all of them did with Clannagael. I mean, it was a fantastic team. We'd Mickey Whelan and Paddy Holden. You know, we had the Davies, Eugene and Jerry that played with Dublin. Victor Black played with Dublin. Christy Kane, who won an All-Ireland with Dublin. I mean, we had such an array of talent with Clans at that time. And we won the county championship. Obviously, we won the Dublin County Championship, which was for the first time, which in any club's history is brilliant, winning it for the first time. And I was just so happy to be a part of that team, winning it with eight inter-county subs on the bench, and you actually out playing, which was... I was playing corner forward. Yeah, that was my position. Sometimes when the likes of Mickey Whelan then went out, I was moved down into the half-forward line, you know.
Would you have been described as a nippy corner forward?
No, maybe not by a few opponents I wouldn't be. No, but yeah, I done my fair share of scoring. I was leading scorer with the club for maybe 2 years, and getting us to the final. I scored quite a few goals and points getting us to the final, you know. We beat, I think, Sing Street the semi-final in Croke Park, and then we played Scully Connell. That's who we beat in the final in Croke Park. So, you know, it's Gaelic football and hurling is my first love, and will always be my first love. Erin's Isle now is my club. I'm with Erin's Isle about 27 years as well. And I mean, that's my club. That's the place I come back to put my feet down after international football, because they don't allow you to fly any heights. There's no prompt or ceremony with Erin's Isle and with the Gaelic in terms of being a superstar or he's physio to the Irish team. I'm Mick. When I come back to my Gaelic club, I'm Mick, and that's it, Mick the physio.
When talking about Erin's Isle and talking about goalkeepers, the great Kerry goalkeeper, Peter O'Leary, who's only recently retired after winning his All-Ireland, when he was a small young fella, I used to bring him up to Erin's Isle from my club, the Killarney Legion. We'd come up with a crowd of 70 young fellas, and Erin's Isle, fabulous club, they always looked after us. Later on then, Mick, jumping around the place, you became physio for inter-county Gaelic teams.
Well, it happened that there was a friend of ours in Dublin, and he asked me, would I give John O'Mahony a dig out with Leitrim when John took Leitrim? Would I look after players? Because they trained the Navan to help the Dublin players in that. The Galway players used to come, and the Dublin players to Navan. So, I just said, yeah, no problems. And so then I went down and looked after the players for Leitrim. They got to the All-Ireland semi-final that time. Dublin beat them. And then when John took over the Galway side, he asked me would I come and work with him. So I was only too delighted. I mean, probably one of the best managers I've ever worked under was John O'Mahony. What a fabulous man. What a fabulous family he has too, in Geraldine and all the girls. And they made me so welcome. I mean, I used to go down Tuesday, Thursday, and then come back home, and then spend the weekends, Saturday training or playing a match, and then stay with John's family overnight on a Saturday, and then go to the matches on Sunday. But I just can't describe the type of... John would be in the mould of Jack and Mick McCarthy and Alex Ferguson. I would rate him that high as a manager.
Mick, I suppose in the GA we're inclined to underestimate our managers. You have Sean Moylan, Mick Dwyer and Billy Morgan, and you have some wonderful managers, and Tommy Lyons and all those. They are all equivalent to what you're talking about.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I've absolutely fantastic respect for anyone involved in the GAA, and particularly the players. The amount of time and effort that they give, I mean, I know it's been highly documented at the time, and the aggro that's going on between, but taking all that aside, the amount of effort the managers, the names you've mentioned, the great managers you've mentioned, I mean the Sean Boylans and the Mick O'Dwyers, and you know the Tommy Lyons is now, and the Tommy Carr, the Pat O'Neills that have left all
Heffernan.
And the legend was this Heffo, you know, he was the Dublin legend that we talk about, as Mick was with Kerry Ankle there, as Sean Boylan is the longest manager ever to serve. I mean, John O'Mahony winning titles with three different counties, you know, unbelievable. Mayo, Galway and Leitrim, you know, you don't get that very often in games.
And of course, Mick, the highlight in probably of your Gaelic sideline activities was winning the All-Ireland with Galway. Talk to us about what year was that, and what was it like?
Oh, I tell you what, it was the greatest experience of my life, being a Gaelic person, loving Gaelic football the way I do, the passion I have for it. It was in 97, 98 when we started. We went along. We were beaten in the under-21s, the under-21 game, and I think against Westmead beat us, if I'm not mistaken, the semi-final. Then we were beaten by Offaly in the quarter-finals of the league in a terrible day in Dr. Hyde Park. And it was that time I said to John, we're going to win in All-Ireland, because you could actually see the team. We'd 16 wides that day and we were beaten by 4 points. But you could see the players and the blend and the team. And I did turn to John and say, John, we're going to win in All-Ireland with this team. And it was then, in going through 98, when we won the All-Ireland. We got out of Connacht after replay. We got out of Connacht. And then it was on to them. We beat, and actually Brian Mullins was with Derry at the time. And, you know, this was sad for me, because Brian was a very good friend of mine, and we knew one another very well, and he's been to a lot of international matches as well. And it was just hard going to Brian and saying, well, look, hard luck. And, you know, but again, we were elated, the Galway people and the players. And what players? I mean, Galway have fantastic players at the minute. They have the makings of a fantastic team again.
Mick, how could you equate the Samogel Guell Cup going up to Galway, and we'd said the Irish team coming back after doing great in the World Cup? Do you know the atmosphere and the feelings of those two particular? Is there a big difference? Is there a void? Are all Irish supporters the same?
No, they're the same. I mean, I used to watch, funny enough, I used to watch and look forward to watching the victorious All-Ireland teams go home down the country, and the trains pulling in, whether it was Cork or Killarney or wherever, whoever won it, up to Down or Derry. And you sat there in amazement looking at this, the team arrived with the Samogel, and here was I. It took us 9.5 hours to get to Galway. We sat down at 5:30 in the morning to have our dinner that we were supposed to have at 10 o'clock that night. It took us so long to get home. We had the bonfires, we had the turf burning right along. It was like a plane landing, the turf burning all the way. The minute we hit the county, the turf, sods of turf were set on fire all the way right in. The bonfires were out on every gate we passed, right past through every town, and we stopped at most of the towns to let the people see the Sam and that. But it was an unforgettable time in my life, because I just can't describe it. And then you're describing coming home from the World Cup in 1994, 88 coming home from the European Championship Finals. The same again, this burning passion of supporters wanting to be there to thank us and thank the players and thank us for what we have achieved for our country. And this is what it is. And I suppose the difference between representing your country and your county is you're doing it for your county. And the passion is all about your county.
I always wonder, Mick, and I must ask you this, the great international soccer players, both English and Irish parentage and all those people, have they a concept of what you have been talking about in relation to the homecoming and Samogel Guell Cup and that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they listen and watch the games all the time over in England. And, you know, they're Irish families. They're Irish families who go to the Irish clubs and do Irish dancing and are all part of our heritage. I mean, these are people who had to go away because of work or whatever reasons. So they're Aird sons and things that are representing their country now. So you don't think they're not English, they're Irish. They're probably more Irish than we are. And this is what upsets me a little bit when you hear people saying, ah, but they're English. But they're English with their fathers and mothers from the likes of Beaufort and the likes of Ballybunion and the likes of Waterford and the likes of Galway and Tipperary and Carlow. And, you know, these are more Irish probably than we are.
I could talk to you about hundreds of players, but I'm just going to talk to you about one particular player who at the moment isn't playing with Kerry. He's opted out for the year. I don't know whether he's finished or not. Maurice Fitzgerald. Now, I could talk to you about loads and loads of players all over Ireland, but Maurice Fitzgerald, I mean, wasn't he something special? Isn't he something special, Mick?
Absolutely superb player. You know, when you look at the... I have to use this word, majestic, because that's what he was. The skill, you're talking about skill and soccer and rugby, and but the skill this lad had, you know, and the joy I got. There was one other player which is my hero, and I have to talk about him, and I live my life looking at him and watching him, was the great Mick O'Connell. And Morris reminds me of the great Mick O'Connell. Now, you know, and to put those two players in into breath, even, but what a player. I mean, head-wise, skill-wise, I mean, you're talking about Roy putting a pass on a sixpence. He could put a pass on a sixpence. He could turn and take a point from 40 yards out from anywhere. This fantastic player. It's a pity. It's a terrible pity the injuries he's had last year, because I think he definitely was a loss, a big loss, a huge loss to Kerry when the injuries start affecting him.
Nick, you've seen the best soccer players in the world, the greatest and the best of them. And how would Morris Fitzgerald have done if he had gone over to England as a young boy and signed up with an English club? How do you think he'd have come out of it?
Well, I think the same, with the passion and the skill and everything this lad has about reading the game and all like that. You could only think of him. These are special players. You're talking about Kevin Morden being with Dublin, winning the All-Irelands with Dublin, and then being able to go and transfer that. Kevin could have played rugby for Ireland. That these type of special players, Paul McGrath is another special player you can talk about that could have turned his hand to any game. And being special, oh well, Roy, of course, Roy is a world-class player. You know, Roy, you talk about Roy with the Ronaldos and all these fantastic Brazilians and Argentinians and Germans and Italians. And Roy is on that stage. Dennis Irwin as well. What about Dennis? Fantastic full-back for Man United. Oh, absolutely brilliant. I mean, and brilliant for Ireland as well. So, you know, when you're talking about these, the Gaelic footballers, Michael Donlan. Look at Michael. What do you take of a player like that? Pádraig Joyce. Oh, I think Pádraig Joyce is the most underrated player in the country. Fabulous to watch.
Nick, we better start talking a bit about soccer. because we could be going on all day. Anyway, your soccer career, it began because you took over, you managed teams and coached teams. Bring us up along now, how all that evolved.
No, I never managed teams. I got involved with the training. I obviously done physical education. I qualified as a physical education teacher and went on from that into physiotherapist and massage as it was at that time. And was dead keen on that, to be able to train the players and treat them, which I thought was important, because you were working with them both on and off the field, and then giving them your lot and getting their trust and building up their trust, and that's really very important. So I started with a great side named Red United. It was a friend of ours, which is now the Manchester United scout, Joe Corcoran, and Joe introduced me to this lad who ran the team. So I took over the training of the team, and very successful, won everything at schoolboy level, or under 18 level, and then moved on. Shelburne management liked what I was doing and asked me to take over their first team. So I went from that into Shelburne to train the first team, and then we got in, we qualified, we won the Shield that year and qualified for Europe for the first time in a while that Shelburne had done that. And then after that, then Billy Young asked me would I go to Shamrock Rovers, because Billy was in charge. So I said yeah, no problem. So I went with Billy to Shamrock Rovers, and then we were toured in the league in the semi-finals of the cup. But Billy had a falling out with the management, the Shamrock Rovers at the time, and he left, and so I walked out with Billy, because I believed in what he was doing and I believed in everything he did. He was a fantastic manager as well. So then I went to Athlone Town under Mick Dalton. Asked me to go to Athlone Town, and Mick is dead, Lord of mercy on him, he's dead. And then Dougie Wood from the north then took over as well, and we had famous players playing with them too, the likes of the Mick O'Briens and the John Gibbons is actually now, who is an agent. John played for Athlone as well with me, and there was loads of other players, Johnny Fallon now, who was an Umbro rep with the Irish team. Actually, he played with Athlone with me as well. So, you know, it's well dotted around the place. But Then I went, Billy had got the job at Bohemians, and I went to, back to Bohemians with Billy, and we won everything then in Irish football. We won the cups, we won the leagues, we won the President's Cups, we won the top four, we won the Shields. Oh, we won so many trophies with Bohemians, it was untrue. I think we were about 15 times played in Europe, in the European Cup and also in the UEFA Cup at the time. And, you know, we were there on a regular basis. And then John Giles asked me to go with the under-21s with Alan Kelly Senior, Alan's father. So I went along and I said, yeah, and that was a great honour to go with the under-21s to a tournament in Toulon in France. And we done all right, you know, over there. And then when I came back then, John approached me and asked me would I go full-time to Shamrock Rovers with him, because he had these developing squads, you know, in Shamrock Rovers. They used to be apprentices and full-time at the time. That was what's been done now. John done that 20, 25 year ago, and he was criticised for it. And now it's all the go now, today. So you can say we were 25 years before our time, you know, in terms of the development and full-time professional and the development of younger players. I mean, the Jim Beglins, the Alan Campbells, the Liam Buckleys, the Harry Kennys, they all came from that group of players that John had as apprentices with Shamrock Rovers. So it was really the start of it. And then John asked me to go to full senior squad, and that was my first time I was introduced to that.
Now, John Giles was the manager of the Irish team at that particular time, Mick. Now, you take us up from when you became involved, what year you became involved in, and who, bring us up along the line up to the present day, in the line of the managers.
Yeah, well, it was Giles, he was the first one I went to it, which was, Giles was a fantastic manager, a player's man, well respected by the pros, Liam Brady's and all, Frank Stapleton's, Dave O'Leary's. He had all them. He brought. He had all them under Steve Highways, you know, all these great players at the time, and John had all them at that time. And you know, we done really well without doing great with the players we had. But then you had the great sides as well. You know, the Dutch and the French, and they were all great sides. The Eastern Europeans, which were under the communist regime at the time, they were all great sides as well, the Czechoslovakians and all them, you know, all great sides. And then John left, and Alan Kelly Senior took over them for two games, and Preston wouldn't release them, so Alan had to relinquish his post as the manager. So then Owen Hahn took over. So Owen went on there, and like unlucky, as they say, we should have qualified a couple of times when, you know, the referees were dreadful. I mean, Frank Stapleton's goals against the Dutch and that, and the French, and you know, we were just, he was unlucky that we didn't qualify in terms of that. But then again, they say you make your own luck in football.
What was the defining moment in Juan Hen's career, Mick? I can't recollect really. There was some particular game, wasn't there?
No, we went out to play Russia out in the qualifiers, and we were beaten 2-1. Very unluckily beaten. I think it was 2-1, and anyway, Jim Beglin was taken down in the box, and we should have got a penalty. We didn't. Results always seem to go against us, but that's probably a cliche. Yeah, but that's a cliche. And you know the moral victories. You're beaten 2-0, but it was a great display and all this. And, you know, we had to get away from that. We had to get a belief in ourselves. And then Jack came on board then, this mysterious man from, you know, from Northumberland. And then the legend began.
When was your first meeting with Jack Charlton, Mick, and how did he impress you?
Oh, Jack was Jack. He was great. I got a phone call by Joe Delaney from Tipperary to tell me that Jack wanted to meet me in the Westbury Hotel. Joe was involved with the FAI as treasurer at the time, and he said he wants to meet you at the Westbury Hotel now. Make sure you're there. And so I went to the Westbury Hotel. A friend gave me a lift over, and I walked in, of course, said hello to Joe, and then sat down with Jack. And of course Jack said, well, I don't know you from Adam, you know. And I said, well, I know you, because we had played Leeds when I was with Shelburne. We played Leeds in a friendly game in Dalyman Park, actually they beat us 2-1, and I actually was chatting to him with John Giles in the ballroom after the game, but he wouldn't have remembered that at the time. But you know, he just said, oh well, you know, if you can give me a dig out, we're playing Wales, and if you can give me a hand with, I don't know the player, I don't know much about anything, so I'll need you to help. So I did. I explained everything to Jack at the time, and so then after the game, we were beaten 1-0 by Wales. Ian Rush scored a goal, and
if I remember correctly, the Welsh goalkeeper had an injury that night.
That's right, he broke. Yeah, Neville Southall broke his ankle. I actually brought him up to the hospital, and I went to visit him in the hospital. You're right, exactly. And then you know, we beat him. But anyway, Jack was thrilled, and Jack just said, "Well, look, I'm really pleased with you. I'm pleased with what you do for the players. They seem to all look up to you, and will you take the job?"
And you took the job, didn't you, Mick? And the whole thing turned around. How did Jack Charlton turn a mediocre team into a World Cup great side? What did he bring to the whole scene in Ireland? Was it the fact that he was from a foreign land, and that maybe our own people, familiarity breeds contempt, and they wanted an outsider? How did that come into it?
No, I think Jack just came over, and being from where he was, the background Jack had and all, I think, again, something similar to what the Irish are. Loves the crack, loved a few pints, and loved to sit down and have a chat and a sing-song and all. He's very into that. And I think that, you know, the Newcastle people and all are very close to the Irish, and that's a lot of Irish people around there. And Jack knew probably the temperaments as well. And obviously, winning a World Cup medal himself and that gave him this, the players' respect, and the players looked up to him for that. But he did. I remember out in the Holiday Inn now that we're in, that we stay at the minute, it used to be the Forty Crescent. But Jack got us all in a circle and asked us to do what he asked us to do, and we would win games. Play the way I ask us to play, and we'll win games. And fair dues to him. He got the nucleus. He got John Aldridge, then he got Ray Houghton, then Andy Townsend came. You know, he got very good players then on board. I mean, he had some very, very good players. He had Paul and Kevin, and then he had Mick as well. You know, he had Packy, Jerry Payton. He had some tremendous players, Chris Hughton, Chris Morrison. You know, we had some terrific players at Frank up front, you know, and then you had Dave O'Leary there. So, you know, we had players in their prime, and he gelled that together, and he said, you know, do what I ask you to do, and we'll beat these teams.
And for you then, during his term, Mick, what were the highlights? Everybody had their own highlights, but for you, what were your highlights of the Jack Charlton era, as 'tis known now?
Well, obviously, qualifying in 88 was, for the first time, which I never ever thought I'd ever see Ireland qualify for anything, to be totally honest. I just thought we were an international team, but never ever thought we'd qualify. So, you know, Bulgaria done us a terrific favour that time, or Scotland, by beating Bulgaria, and it was absolutely fantastic, and we were there in the finals. And I think that was the turning point. That was the belief the players got, and everyone in the country. Remember, they talk about the Celtic Tiger and all like that. It started at that time. It started in 88 when we qualified, and when we performed to the ability that we performed. And the people then got this belief, because then Irish athletes start doing well. Irish rugby teams start doing well. Everything Irish start doing well. Whether it was either a coincidence or just the mere fact that we had this belief that we could go out and compete against the best in the world.
Ronnie Delaney, the great Olympian, told me in an interview that I was lucky enough to get with him, that when he won the gold medal in 1956 in Melbourne, that it lifted the whole country. So what we're talking about here, Mick, is that the success of Irish people and the success of inter-county teams lift populations.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, that goes without saying. I mean, you look at the hype that's going to be this year, because we've qualified for Japan and Korea even at the minute. Look at the hype that there was in 1990, and who will ever forget 1990? No one will ever forget. Everyone knows where they were when Packy saved and Dave O'Leary scored a penalty. Everyone knows where they were. 94, when we qualified for America, this time when we weren't to qualify against Portugal and Holland. They were the hammerers out of sight. We weren't to be even in it. And yet we beat the Dutch here and qualified for the World Cups.
When Packie was lining up to save the penalty, and when David O'Leary was lining up to kick the penalty, McBurnie was standing in the sideline. Could you bring us back to that moment in time, those two particular incidents, which stands etched in everybody's memories, just like the man landing on the moon?
Yeah, well, that's a fact. I mean, oh, your mind goes back to that, and you think of all the emotions that runs through your body at the time, and your mind, and Jack was watching the big screen. Jack couldn't watch the penalties. Jack was turned around and watched someone give him. He used to always ask the punters at the game, all the fans, for cigarettes. They used to all pass him in cigarettes and he'd be smoking away. But he never looked. I walked up to him, he didn't look. But he said he was looking at a big screen. There was a big screen, but I don't believe him. I just don't think he looked at it. And I was on, walking up and down. I think I prayed to every saint that was ever known. And I know Packie had his special clay he got from someone in Donegal that was supposed to be holy clay. And he said, say a prayer at me, say a prayer at me. I remember being out when we were rubbing them for the penalties and that, and out and stretching them and getting the cramp all right. And he said, Mick, say a prayer, say a prayer. I said, Packie, I'll say 20 prayers. So going up and down, I was walking up and down at the time, the line. And that, but I knew, because every penalty was struck, Packie went the right way. He was very unlucky, didn't save, very close. And I said, he's definitely going to save one. So your man stepped up, and anyway, and Packie stretched out his big paws, because that's what you can call huge hands, and he stretched her out. And then, of course, Dave came up. And for Dave to take, I mean, I knew Dave O'Leary since he was about 8 or 10, and all his family and his granny and all. And for Dave to stand, never seen him take a penalty. I was shaking in my boots, because you didn't know what to expect. Oh, but what a penalty. Fantastic penalty, stuck it away, beautiful. Ah, we are. Well, I think I was the first. I was dragging Dave and Packie. Yeah, there was hugs and cheers and everyone. I mean, everyone in the crowd just went absolutely mad.
Mick, looking back in retrospect now, it was particularly great that was David O'Leary scored the penalty, because he had run into a bit of hassle with Jack Charlton. He had left Jack down and he'd gone away on holiday. Jack had kind of got rid of him, that's what it was in a nutshell. And then he came back and then he scored the penalty. So that really took everything else off of his mind, any bad memories he might have of Ireland, didn't it?
Yeah, well, again, that's all, you know, that's the way it was at the time. But when Dave came back into it, he came back, he's a professional, and I mean, that's it. People are left out and left in and are dropped and come back in, and they're professionals, and that's the way they are. And this is the way. There was no one. He stood up to take that penalty, he stood up and he just slotted it home.
And then along came a man by the name of Mr. Scalacci.
That's right. That was really disappointing, because I thought, even in the dressing room at half time, I thought we would beat Italy. I honestly did. And there was a couple of mistakes. The mistakes were made by us. You know, John, Kevin Cheedy, John giving the ball away. You know, Kevin Cheedy, you know, instead of giving Planer into his feet, ball cleared, Scalacci on his own, you know, and, you know, Packie pamming the ball, saving it, and then it going loose to Scalacci and he knocking it home. And then,
I suppose, Mick, he's the most favourite Italian in Ireland, is he?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, everyone will remember. That's the only thing, yeah. The only thing is, you know, I think the most favourite Italian of mine is my chip on Mount Carmine, to be honest with you. You know, it fills me full of chips every time I go up. But no, yeah, he will be. I mean, that was devastating for us. That was really... so close. That was it. But I think my gut feeling, if we can have this team going out fit to Japan, I've a tremendous gut feeling about this team we have now.
Your three favourite memories of the Jack Charlton era before we go on to the present team?
Well, obviously the qualifying for the first tournament ever Ireland were ever in, for a small country, 3 million people, and being able to be on that stage with the greatest in the world, which have a selection of unbelievable selections. My other one would be, would be obviously, my other one would be being with Jack. Obviously, that would be my meeting him for the first time and being with this big man, gruff man. But my most important one would be meeting the Pope, certainly. That would be my most important thing of all time.
Where would you rate beating England?
Oh, well, I tell you, I mean, who would have thought on a foreign soil, in Germany, above all places, beating it? Oh, I cried. I absolutely cried. I think everyone cried. Everyone cheered. I remember the grown people, grown men in the stands, when we went to them, were crying, roaring and crying they were. You know, this was history. This was history. I mean, beating the Sassenachs. I mean, you know, here we are, the West awakes. Name what you like. You know, it was absolutely fantastic.
And then along came Mick McCarthy, of course. And you knew him, of course, from play from his playing days. You treated him and everything. You probably still treating him, I suppose. It was, he's getting old, like all of us. He wants a bit of treatment. But along came Mick McCarthy. Then he changed the style then completely. And he stuck with it. And he got it right, despite criticisms. But he changed the style completely. Even through the qualifying stages, superb stuff. They're playing wonderful football, and you never know, they're so good. No, we don't know what's going to happen. Mick McCarthy changed everything again, didn't he?
Yeah, well, when Mick took over, yeah, he did. He changed the whole, kept everything the way it was in terms of everything we do, going to the pitches on a Monday night, you know, everything, the training times, everything we do, we kept all that intact, but certainly changing the coaching, changing his way. He put his brand on the way he wanted it done, in fairness to him. Criticised, yeah, earlier on we missed out on two qualifiers just by the playoffs, which people don't realise. I mean, these are the playoffs. Macedonia, 3 seconds, a corner kick, and we were out. Turkey, 0-0 in Turkey, and we were out because we gave away a goal here. And people don't realise how close we were to qualifying with these teams. But then we got it all, and everything was gelling nicely. Got another few players in, got the Robbies in, the Damien Dust, Chemical Bands, Jason producing it. And then, of course, the World Cup, you know, our World Cup star, Roy. You know, what can you say? You can't say anything about Roy Keane. He's the master. He's probably... Well, he is, not probably. He's one of the best players in the world. And Mick, and we gelled all that together and got everyone on the right frame of mind, knowing we could play football. We could get it down, we could beat these teams. And, you know, to go out and beat the Dutch with 10 men, an array of talent you would not believe. The Clive Ertz, the Hasselbanks, you know, the Cook, every one of them there. And we beat them in Lansdowne. That was probably the best game ever Ireland played. The greatest result Ireland ever had was against Holland and Lansdowne Road this year to qualify for the World Cup.
Cameroon, Saudi Arabia and Germany, they are waiting for us outside in Japan. Capable, Mick, of beating the three of them.
Oh, without a doubt, a fit side. Give us the fit team. Give us the team Mick wants for our fit. I would play anyone. I would be confident going out against any team with that team.
No, Mick. Mick McCarthy, and he'd be looking after the training, the coaching side of it. Mick Byrne is the physiotherapist. What are you packing? What does a physiotherapist bring to a World Cup with him? The man that's looking after an Irish international team. What must you do? What are you bringing with you, Mick?
Well, of course, there'll be everything that you'll need. As I said, we're in three other major championship finals, so you know this one is no different. So we will bring the quantity of stuff that we need. It's instead of 6 days, we're going to be for 30 days. So we need the quantities of stuff, such as, you know, the Lucozade certainly for the extra energy and the extra benefits you need for the heat and the humidity. And then we'll have the Aurolite, which we use as well for to replace what you need, the salt in your body, the potassium in your body, that needs to be replaced. So we have all, that'll be all with us. The mountain loads of strappings and tapings and Vaselines and rubs and baby oil and stuff that we'll have with us as well. I think there'll be about five medical skips going out to Japan and Korea. Yeah.
Talking about injuries, I must mention cruciate, torn cruciate ligaments, groin injuries, and I suppose dead beat and hamstrings. Now, we hear an awful lot about them. Maybe in your time, maybe even my time, they weren't as prevalent. Why are they more as prevalent now? How do you treat them? And Roy Keane is a typical example, and Kevin Moran with his hamstring. Talk to us about that side of sport.
Yeah, well, it's just I suppose it's they're professionals, so with their clubs, they would be getting treatment probably twice, three times a day, plus they would have all the facilities that they need to get these, because these need our players back quickly, because clubs in the Premiership and stuff like that need our players, so they would have. But in terms of what we do, we have a great medical team ourselves, with the likes of Martin Walsh, he's a surgeon, and Kieran Murray's the other physio with me, and myself, and you know, we're dealing with this all the time. The only thing is your longer period, you know, we have a longer time to deal with all this, whereas with the players come in on a Sunday, they have niggles and they have knocks, you treat them, there's no problems. But if they have a major problem, well then you know, Martin will have a look at them and decide then that they're better off going back to their clubs, and we just send them back to their clubs.
Nick, when was the first torn cruciate ligament that came under your jurisdiction, as the fellow says? Can you remember when it started?
Well, yeah, it started back, I think it started back in, way back. Well, it would have started a way back, but people would have been nearly finished if they had that injury. Yeah, it was so serious, But now, it's so repairable now. I mean, the surgeons now are absolutely fantastic. I mean, they're geniuses. They're brilliant, absolutely brilliant men that can get these, reconstruct the knee and get these players back playing at the top of that. I mean, Roy had it done. Niall Quinn had two done, plus one went again. So you're talking about Alan Shearer. You know, you're talking about all these fantastic players that had them. And these men, these geniuses of men, are able to get them back playing at the very highest level, at international football again, even though they do it. Van Nistelrooy with Man United, everyone was saying, oh, he's finished, he's out. And that's when Man United pulled out the deal that they were supposed to do with him.
At the moment, recovering. Your message now to a man that's listening to you that is going for a cruciate ligament, a torn ligament operation, or maybe recovering from them, there's great prospects.
Oh, without a doubt, he'll play again. He just has to do his rehab and do what, you know, his surgeon tells him to do, and his physios tell him to do. Obviously, the rehabilitation is so important that you have to do it right. Make sure you don't come back too soon. Make sure you don't rush it. There's not a match there you want to play in. There'll be loads of matches to play in once he's right, once he's 100% right. And 100% right he will be. Have no fear of that. The top players playing in England have all had serious career-threatening injuries, and they've come through them because they've done it all right. They've rehabilitated properly.
The lads from Killarney Athletic and Killarney Celtic now listening in, and the lads from Kerry and my own club, Legion, Crokes and Killarney, torn hamstrings, they're coming in. How would Mick Byrne, what would his advice be to them?
Yeah, well, the same again. You've got to assess them. You've got to have them assessed by the proper people. And then you've got to have the treatment for them that obviously they will have, because there's the terrific, fantastic treatments out there now that you can have. But there again, it's the player managing his injury. It's man-managed. It's him managing his injury. You train with no pain. That's the secret of it. And in his rehabilitation, coming back from a hamstring, it's easy being... The worst thing, I think, is they're put under pressure by their coaches and managers for to play. And being an amateur sport like that, it's totally different, because they want to play. And they go out half fit, or not right. And so they go out, maybe break down after 20 minutes and miss the rest of the season. Take your time coming back. Make sure you do a proper rehabilitation program. Make sure you build it right up, from the walking to the sprinting, to the ball work, to the shuttle work, and everything you have to do.
Nick, you have been, and you will be, and your managers you've worked under have been and will be under fierce media attention when you're out in Japan, and have been all along like that. you'd see a lot of Boston. You get a lot of media people. They mightn't maybe, as the fellow said, tell the fair story. How does the media come into your work and Mick McCarthy's work and Jack Charlton? And yeah, how did all that side of your life go?
Well, it's like you're here with me. You know, you can only tell it as you see it. And I mean, hopefully we would hope that the journalists, in which they have, in fairness to them, most of them have been brilliant to us. They're doing a job. They have a job to do. And if we can help them in doing that job by telling as it is, we will do that. I mean, because they have a job. They have family support, a job to do. But then we expect the same from them. It's trust. And if a player, if a journalist says something offhand that he shouldn't say about players, well, then the players will just rubbish him. And he's losing out because it's his livelihood as well. Not only the players, it's the journalist's livelihood. So if they're fair and do what's right, and everyone accepts criticism. I mean, no one's above it. You'll accept it. If it's wrong, it's wrong. If they write what they see is wrong, no cribs with that. But it's only when they start the niggly stuff and, you know, all this kind of stuff that shouldn't be written, that's when it gets the players back up.
Make a few quick ones for us before we finish up, because your phone will be hopping out there soon. I hope there's all good news. By the way, waiting for phone calls between here now and in 10 days' time. The people are listening to this. You're out in Japan at the moment now. But between the time you go now and when you go, that phone is going to be ringing. You're hoping. Are you hoping not?
Yeah, well, obviously, the Gary Kelly's testimonial went off all right. And we have Niles, we have Roy playing, obviously, for United 2 games, and we have all the rest of the lads playing at the weekend, you know, and we have, yeah, tense time, you know, all the Premier matches, Damien Duffy playing, Robbie be playing, Gary be playing, Ian Hart, Shea Given, you know, all the players, Ken Cunningham, but they're finished, all the First Division are finished, but all the Premier ones will, next Saturday is a big day. Then Niall's testimony is a big one. The Nigerian game is a big one. So all we can hope for is that all the players that have been picked on the panel of 23 will, on the Thursday night before we leave on the 16th, will be happy and ready to get onto that plane on the Friday.
The Irish supporters, they seem to be a second team when they follow you.
Oh, they're absolutely unbelievable. You just don't know the rapport that there is between the team and the players. And I mean, this no one can mistake, and no one can underestimate the importance of this 12th player on the pitch, because that's what the Irish supporters are to us. They're a 12th player on the pitch. To see them go out, and when you hear them singing the fields of Athenry and we're on the one road or wherever, the hair stands up on the back of your head. When Aaron Aveen has been playing and you're singing it, the hair stands up on the back of your head. But the fans make it for us. You know, we cannot thank the fans enough, I have to say. For all over the years, through the bad times and the good times, they've stuck with us. Bill Crope filled Lansdowne Road. Unbelievable for friendly games. Sellouts. Oh, unbelievably. The Irish only want to sing and have the crack. That's all we want. We're a nation. That's our heritage.
What part of your job don't you like, Mick?
I don't think there's a part of the job I don't like. You know, my job is with the players and with Mick, you know, and that's my job. My job is everything that the players do, I'm involved in. Everything that Mick does, I'm involved in. And that's, I couldn't say, to be honest with you, what part. There's nothing, I suppose coming home, and when we're finished, coming home, that's the part I don't like, because I'm leaving them and they're going away and I've got to put them on the planes. I've got to call them in the morning to get up and get the planes, whether it be Mulholland at 4:45 call or Stephen Staunton or a 9 o'clock call or Niall or a 10 o'clock call or wherever. I've got to get them onto the planes. I've to see them in and see them off.
Rattle off the top players you've seen back through the years, anywhere, not Ireland, but your best players.
Well, you know, you can talk about the Crifes and the Liam Brady's. You can talk about Maldini's. You can talk about the Pelés and all of these fantastic players, and then the Frank Stapletons, the Andy Townsends, John Aldridge, Ray Houghton, then the Gary Kellys, Ian Hart, Shay Givens, Paddy Bonner, you know, Gary Breen, Ken Cunningham, Mark Kinsella, the young song hero, the brilliant midfielder. You know, you can talk about these. We've talked about Roy, about world-class Dennis Irwin, you know, Chris Hughton, Chris Morrison. You know, you can talk all about Dave Langan, which was a fantastic full-back for us as well. Fortunately, badly injured at the minute, gone through a bad time. But you can talk about all these players, you know, Steve Highway, Johnny Giles, fantastic players, you know, in their own right.
What was the first Irish international soccer match you ever saw?
Oh, that's going back when I was a kid, when I used to have to disguise myself going up into Dalymount Park, because, as you know, the ban was on that time. So you used to have to pull your collar up and make sure there was no one watching, because Gaelic games are so important to you that, you know, if you saw going to see a soccer match, you were banned. And I know two lads out of my clubs who were banned.
Yes, yeah, Mick, you should never ask a lady her age. Now, you don't mind me asking you your age, do you?
I do, yeah. I'm not going to say her age I am, obviously.
What year did you play minor?
My paper age is 56, you know, so you can take it from there.
Mick, one quick one. There's a lot of talk at the moment about Gaelic players getting paid. Do you think it would be a good thing or a bad thing for the game?
I think knowing what I went through, knowing the travelling I did with the inter-county teams, with the Galway team, knowing what I did personally myself, leaving this house at 2 o'clock in Ashbourne, getting to Ballinasloe or Tuam, and then training, leaving there at half, getting back home at 3 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, and on a Friday morning when I went on a Thursday. And you tell me that these players shouldn't be paid, should be reimbursed, not pay, because I know pay is a deadly word to most of the people in the GAA, but these people, these players deserve a reward. I don't know which way they're going to give it to them, pay their mortgages, pay for new cars for them, pay whatever debts they have, do something for them. I mean, they're out there. Remember, as I say, and it was said to me by a very famous man just there Friday night, it was said to me, the players employ the administrators. The administrators wouldn't be in their jobs only for the players. So the players employ the administrators in Croke Park, in the FAI, and in the rugby union. Without the players, those people wouldn't have the highly paid jobs that they have. So I think if that clicks with the administrators, that they're earning their hundred thousands a year plus expenses or whatever, that these players are generating the money for them people to be paid that money, there's something in that. And I think that should be thought about by the administrators as well. Why have I this job? Why have I this job at 100,000 a year? It's because of those players that are bringing in the money and the revenue. Sponsors don't want to sponsor administrators. They want to sponsor players. They want their billboards up in Croke Park on match days when them players walk out across the pitch. So this has to be taken into consideration. It has to be reversed. The administrators don't employ the players. The players employ the administrators. So when that clicks with them, I'm sure they will say, well, my God, I'm earning 100,000 plus, and here's players getting 30 pence a mile for travelling all night to wherever venue they have to travel to. And certainly I agree with them being reimbursed, as I said, whether it's paying their mortgages, whether it's giving them €125, a pittance, in my opinion, to players that have given 5 nights a week to training and playing.
You've seen it all. Mick, what would your special quotation be to players? You must have a special saying that you'd be remembered for by the Irish players. What would your little bit of advice be to me, your quotation?
No, I'm there as the patriarch and the matriarch and the mother and father They come to me with their problems, they come to me with their troubles. If there's anything they want to say to Mick, I go and say it to him. If he wants to say it to the players, I go and say it to them. And this is, I'm just there, a shoulder to cry on, to lift the player if he's down, because when he's up, he doesn't need to be lifted in any way. When they're playing well and everything is going great for them, whether it's Gaelic football or hurling or rugby or anything, players that are playing well and doing well and all, it's the players that are injured, the players that are feeling a bit down, maybe being left out, they're the players you need to have a little word with and have a little bit of extra generosity towards.
And of course, there's a soccer widow in this house, and there's a family who'll be without a father. Talk to me about who are you leaving behind, and have your grandchildren, or what's going to happen when you're gone?
I've two grandchildren, which are the treasures of my life. They're the children that I didn't see growing up, and I have time. Isabella is here with us because our mother works like every other mother, and we're lucky enough that we can take care of her. Some poor unfortunate mothers have to put them in crèches and pay enormous money for them. We can mind. Siobhan can leave Isabella off, and Thomas's Ellen is my other grand, and his their mother-in-law takes care of her. So they're lucky in that they don't have to put them into crèches and pay this enormous monies that they have to. But then I have Michael, who is my son, and Thomas is my other son. Deirdre, who is a secondary teacher in Tenerife, she teaches English over there, but is a qualifier, the HDIP and all that she's done in UCD. But she decided to go to Tenerife and live the good life over there and teach over there. And then I have Anne, who is working in Arnott's, who is working on the design, she works on designs, art and design, does windows displays, inside displays. And then I have Siobhan, who's in the Eastern Health Board, who's one of these that helps all the people in the Eastern Health Board.
Mick, last week or the week before, I just chatted to former Greg Cockcuddle. He's after lunch in his book Hooked, and he was down to the studio with me, and he promised me that if Waterford won the All-Ireland, he'd come down specially for Terrace Talk. Now, if Ireland win the World Cup, I am inviting you down to Terrace Talk. Will you come?
Oh, without a doubt, I'd walk down. I'll walk the country with the World Cup if we won it, if we were just lucky enough, and you know, if everything goes well for us. But again, there's no problems ever going down to Kerry. I mean, I'd go down to Kerry any time.
Mick Byrne, it was an honour and a privilege and a pleasure to have you on Terrace Talk. You're a tonic to meet. You're a lovely person, and I have no doubt with the likes of you and the coaching team behind the Irish team, you're going to do us proud out in Japan. Mick Byrne, thank you for joining me, Terrace Talk.
Thank you very much.